How can you achieve and maintain business growth? Harvard Business School Executive Education is now accepting applications for a new program, Driving Profitable Growth. Taking place in Boston from October 25th through the 28th, this program focuses on business expansion and organizational growth strategies that can lead your company into the future. Learn more about this three-day program for senior leaders by visiting hbs.me/growth. That's hbs.me/growth.
You are Locked On Thunder, your daily podcast on the Oklahoma City Thunder, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Hello there, everyone. We're locked in for episode 232 of Locked On Thunder, presented by the Norman Transcript. I'm your host, Fred Katz. Locked On Thunder is part of the Locked On Podcast Network. You can head to iTunes. You can search Locked On Thunder there and subscribe to the podcast once you're on. And if you're feeling real generous, if you like the show, if you have an extra 30 seconds of time, you can leave a review right there. You can leave 5 stars. That always helps with the ratings on iTunes and all that kind of stuff. Find us on audioboom.com as well. Log on to normantranscript.com. You can see my work normally. Those who have listened to the past couple shows know I'm on vacation right now from work. So podcasting in the middle of vacation. Still doing the couple of podcasts Tuesdays, Thursdays, just like always. But no actual writing for me this week. I'm going to be back at work writing on Monday, the 14th of August. So I'll be back next week. For today, though, and for Thursday, just going to be podcasts. And today we've got an interesting guest. This is a podcast I've been talking about doing for a little while now. Not someone who is an NBA player or NBA reporter, which is normally what I got, but we got Michele Berra on the line. And Michele, why don't you tell the people what you do and who you are?
Well, thanks, Fred, for having me on first. And yeah, I do basketball analytics, basically, in the sense that my project, which is called Chartside, that I do with my friend Nicolo Ciuppani, basically developed a software for teams that allows you to like do interesting stuff with videos, analysis, and also maybe the charts that you saw online, charts like the one that Kirk Olbsery originally produced like a few years ago.
You know what I'm really into, which is something that we don't really have. I really like the screening data.
Yeah, I mean, that thing was basically one of the main projects we had a couple of months ago with Vantage Sports. Basically, we were trying to visualize stuff that weren't currently visualized as maps, because, I mean, everyone basically has shot charts right now. You can find them everywhere online. And so we thought, like, deeply about that, and we came out with this idea to doing maps for both off-ball and on-ball screening, and giving like volume data. So the biggest the square was on the field, the more screens you had in that position, and with the colors, you could tell immediately if that area was good for screening for that team or if it wasn't good. And for good, we mean like screen that directly leads to a good pass or an open shot or actual points. And doing that, we discovered like, and we discussed that a couple of weeks ago, very, very interesting data. And yeah, so that was something that we were very proud of. And we are replicating it, of course, in our software.
Yeah, because I love the screening stuff because, you know, the average person isn't going on. The average person does not have a Synergy account, and the average person is not going on NBA.com, and the average person probably doesn't even know that Synergy provides some information to NBA.com. You can go on there and see, like, what Russell Westbrook averages, you know, on his pick-and-roll possessions. But even so, like, even if you factor in those plays where there are screens, because they have, like, you know, points per possession when somebody's running off a screen, or points per possession for a pick and roll ball handler or for a pick and roll roller or something like that, which factors in the concept of an actual screen, because by definition there are screens in those plays. Like, it's still so incredibly flawed. Like, those are only plays that end a possession. So, like, if you run a pick and roll and then, you know, it doesn't do anything, and then you pull back out, you go into an isolation. That's an isolation possession, and the pick and roll statistically according to that model of stats, like that the pick and roll never even occurred. And that's absolutely something that, you know, needs to or can be improved upon. Even though these stats are really cool with the way that they have them, they're still misleading in that sense. And also the ones on NBA.com, the ones on Synergy will go a little bit more into more detail. You can see, you know, pick and roll, points per possession, pick and roll, including passes and that kind of stuff. But it's still extremely catered to the individual and not necessarily how the team does. And I think it's still the perspective of like who has the ball and what is the ball doing. And for these, they're kind of what is the screen doing? How effective is the screen as opposed to how is the ball when there's a screen involved? And I think that stuff is really interesting because it makes it a lot more easy to use when you're just talking about how this actually affects the game and how you can figure this stuff out, you know?
Yeah, I mean, we have measures that we actually took from our experience with the Vantage Sports that tells the user when a screen is good or not. So when you tag the game, when you insert information into the game, you can really carefully say if a screen is good or not. Just the screen, not the outcome. So if the screen actually gives an advantage to the user, so either the screen makes contact or reroute the defender for Thunder fans. I mean, when Steven Adams actually set a screen, that is almost always the case. I remember his data back to like 1 year and a half ago. He was like top of the league on that. So just to see that, I mean, it's very important because then you're right. I mean, the outcome of the screen really depends on how the team is using that or how the player is using that. So Russell Westbrook, for example, has like very high level of screen outcome because you basically use the screen to either make a clear pass to one like one teammate that is open, or it goes to the basket. So it's very productive. And if you see like the screens of Oklahoma City, you see like, oh, wow, in on-ball screen, they are amazing. And then you see the Spurs and you watch the same kind of like outcome, and actually they are not very good. But then you see why. And the reason is people use screen in a very different way. So the Spurs using that as a decoy, for example. And if you just see the outcome of that, maybe the number is not so high. So in Synergy, maybe that would be not very high, or all the screens are not captured with their machine. While if you see the map, you can actually go deep and see why and where those screens are used as a decoy, or why and where they are used as a productive screen.
Yeah, you know, let's talk about something because we were both in Vegas for Summer League. Mm-hmm. This is why I like Vegas and Summer League, because you end up talking to people and you end up having these conversations which you will have at no other point in your life.
Yeah, that's right.
So we were both at Vegas for Summer League, and at one point we got into a conversation about Russell Westbrook's off-ball screening.
Yeah.
And his inactivity as an off-ball screener. Do you think that's like, I mean, you watch a lot of Thunder. Like, you are extraordinarily familiar with the Thunder. I want to know your take because you're so familiar with this stuff. I'm really curious. I mean, people talk about is you know, Russell Westbrook and Paul George. George obviously has to adapt to Westbrook, but Westbrook obviously also has to adapt to George. And people talk about in the sense of handling the ball. But one thing that Paul George is really good at is dealing with screens, whether it's running off screens, anything in that sort. He knows how to use screens. Westbrook is not great at using off-ball screens, whether it's because he doesn't like setting them because he just kind of stands there, whether it's because he hasn't really like running off of them. He often like shoes off guys who are running off-ball screens because sometimes it takes away the middle of the floor for a split second when he wants to go. Do you think that that's something that he's going to be able to change about his game, or at least improve about his game? Because I think Paul George and Westbrook is going to work, but that's my biggest question. I think that's the number one thing that Russ has to improve on this year is that off-ball screening, all that different type of off-ball screening stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this goes in two different levels. So the first one is, should Russ use more off-ball screens? And I mean, for with all the numbers we have, last season was really, really efficient for us coming off screens. And in general, using in the few situation he actually used that, and also in situation of like spot ups. I know that these two are not the same. But generally, if you're like a quick player that can put, can set his feet very quickly, and Russell actually can do that, and you are a good spot shooter, then this translates well. So yes, I think he has to use more off-ball screen, especially if those screeners are shooters as well. Because one thing that we actually analyzed in an article that Andrew Schlecht wrote, I guess, again, 2 years ago, about this this exact matter, we were comparing the number of off-ball screen that Steph Curry did and the number that Russ did in, I think it was Steph's first MVP season. And then the number was like, it was puzzling because, I mean, Russ did 80 screen in his entire season, playoffs included. And Steph was at 700 and change. So it was 10 times higher. And those screens were incredibly, incredibly effective. Because if you have like a shooter like Steph that does a screen, then this actually opens a lot of stuff because the defense has to commit immediately. They cannot they cannot stay in between. And so I think that Russ has to use his body because, I mean, he's a big dude. He can do screens if he wants that. And if he can do this kind of stuff with Paul George, that curls or does stuff like that around these screens, I think that that would be a weapon that opens so many things for the Thunder. Whether he actually end up doing that, I'm not sure. First, because I don't know how much Donovan wants to deploy this kind of stuff. You know, of course, more than me. But if he does, then I think that that should be an area where Russ improves because, I mean, Paul George is very, very valuable and he's willing to use screens, maybe more than Durant was when he was here. And so, I mean, I think that definitely this should be an area of improvement for OKC and for Russ in particular.
Yeah, I don't think there's any doubt that Paul George stylistically likes going off screens more than KD does. I think KD was more of a, I mean, obviously he does go off screens, but he's more of, at least in Oklahoma City, he was more of a guy who was going to stand around the wing and he kind of wanted to spot up without as much movement. And Paul George loves running off those curls. He loves when guys set pin downs or Indiana will set those double pin downs for him and he'll come up around the elbow and he'll curl at the elbow. And now he's coming off I'm pretty sure is the best spot up shooting season of his career. I'd have to go back and check the really early seasons and see if there was some fluke early in the year where he probably shot better than he was, you know, when he was a rookie or something like that. But I'm pretty sure was the best, at least the best volume, you know, at this volume with the amount of usage and the amount that they rely on him, his best spot up shooting season of his career. And that's going to be really valuable because he doesn't need the ball there and he's able to use those off ball screens and he's going to have, and you know what? It's going to make Steven Adams a better player too, because Steven Adams is such a good screen setter and something that Andrew and I have talked about. I mean, and you know, Andrew Schlecht well, and Andrew is a friend of the podcast for me. And I go on down to Dunk all the time and he comes on here all the time. And something that we've talked about, I'm sure on both of our podcasts and because we've become good friends, like off the podcast all the time, is the Thunder don't use Steven Adams as well as Steven Adams could possibly be used. He needs to be setting more screens. And the issue is not just, I mean, he's one of the best screen setters in the league. And something that I've spoken about with Billy Donovan is he's the best screen setter in particular types of screens too. Like, I've talked about this with Billy before, just kind of like an after the interview thing where I asked him, is Steven the best flat screen setter in the NBA? And a flat screen is when a guy will come up, like Tim Duncan used to do it all the time. Tim Duncan was the best before he retired. He was the best. Amari Stoudemire was amazing at it and really popularized it when he was with D'Antoni. in Phoenix, and that's when a guy, you know, Thunder fans will probably recognize it when they see it now, because Adams does it all the time. He'll come up as opposed to just coming up and on a ball screen and standing to the left of a guy or standing to the right of a guy. He'll stand behind him, and then he has the discipline when Russ chooses a side to be able to slide over and screen the guy after Russ makes his movement without actually setting a moving screen. It's extremely difficult because most guys who try it before they've actually become expert at it, as Steven does, they will set an illegal screen. And you know what? A lot of the times with Adam, it is illegal. And he's so good at it. He's so good at it that he gets away with it. Because the best screen setters set illegal screens.
All the time.
Right. If you're setting a legal screen, then you're not one of the best screen setters. Kevin Garnett and Draymond Green and all the Warriors stuff that you get with Draymond Green and it used to be Andrew Bogut and now Zaza and all these guys who are really good screen setters. It's like, yeah, they do set illegal screens. It's because the best screen setters are able to get away with this really subtle stuff that referees aren't able to see. It's just not a possibility. So with Steven, he's really good at setting specific types of screens, but they don't use him for very many off-ball screens. And he doesn't end up getting that many screen assists because of the way they use him. And he doesn't set that many screens, period. And I feel like if they're able to use him to set more screens, if now all of a sudden he's a weapon to where you can free up Paul George on those screens he can set low on the block, or maybe they're playing Paul George at the four and him at the five, and he's able to set cross screens down low and these screens that are coming, you know, 10 feet off the ball that set George free or make somebody who shouldn't be guarding Paul George switch onto him. It's just going to make this offense a lot better. And I think Steven's value becomes just so much higher when you have two players like this as opposed to just one.
Yeah, I remember discussing with Andrew and maybe also with you the beginning of the season where actually OKC had for late December, at least three passable shooter on the floor. And Steven was thriving in that. And one of the shooter was Oladipo and the other one was Domantas Sabonis. This year, at least they will have like an amazing shooter in Paul George and a very, very good spot-up shooter in Patrick Patterson. Last year, there was no one that could come out of screens. Like Domas was a standstill shooter and Oladipo loved like the corner threes. And so in some sense, right now, they replaced the corner shooter with Patterson, and now you have Paul George that actually runs into screen. And so you can actually use Steven Adams in that setting. He will have like more space than last year, I think. And also he has more opportunity, as you said, to set screens, also like off-ball screens, when Russ maybe is using another screen setter like Andre Robertson that can actually screen, like can set like high ball screen like he did in the series against Golden State, and maybe you can use Adams to free up George on one of the sides, and so that opens up like many other options for OKC. And I think that Steven, like again with more space and more involvement, will be better also on the defensive end, because this is a thing that yes everyone knows, but if you have your center that is always engaged in the game on the offensive side, then he will be maybe more engaged on the defensive side. And this is something that is always discussed. And I think that for Steven is actually very true, that if he's going on offense, if he's involved, then he's more assertive also on the defensive side.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I think without a doubt, it's true for Steven. I think it's true for the vast majority of players. There are very few guys that can be uninvolved offensively and still come out and give it everything on defense. Usually the guys who are those, Andre Robertson is honestly one of those guys who can be uninvolved offensively and is still locked in defensively. But you know what? Those guys who are those guys, they tend to be the Andre Robertson type, which is if they weren't going at that level on defense, they wouldn't be in the league. Yeah. So they have to go. They have to go that level on defense to survive. It's a different type of mentality. And that's not to say that Steven dogs it. He doesn't. It's not true. But it's just the way it is. Like if you don't get at your job the type of work that you enjoy the most, that is the most fun for you, sometimes it's a little harder to do the gritty stuff, and you'll try and you'll work hard and you'll do all of those things, but it's just from an engagement standpoint, it's a little bit tougher. And that's it's 100% true for the vast majority of NBA players.
Yeah, and also, I mean, if you turn off your mind on offense, then it's harder to be back on defense. I mean, that actually is a thing for many players. If you like, if you do like two or three possessions where you actually don't have to think on offense, because I mean, you just set like your usual screen on that side of the ball, and then Russ goes to the basket, and then you run back. Maybe I mean, it's not that you are not engaged on the game, but your mind doesn't work at the same pace all the time, and it's harder. I mean, and I also think that it's true that Andre is incredible on defense, like every time, but when he is effective on offense, he gets to stay on the court much more, and he's like much more effective also on the defensive end. So yeah, it's true that Andre doesn't need his offensive like activity to be very high in order to be effective. But if that part is also on, then you get him to stay like on the court like all the time, and so it's even better for the team. And another thing, I'm not saying that Steven should be like post up like 20 times per game. That is not what I'm thinking. I think he has to be active, not necessarily the guy that finishes the action, but he has to be part of every single action with his screening. That is basically what I think.
Yeah, well, you know who's a good model? I mean, it's mm-hmm. it's a little bit different, but DeAndre Jordan these last 5 years is a good model.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. And you know what? When DeAndre, I don't know if you remember, I think I've said this on the podcast before, but DeAndre. When was it? It was the last year of Vinny Del Negro. So that was 2012-13. DeAndre was starting, but he wasn't yet like DeAndre Jordan, all caps. You know, he was not he was not an all league center. Like DeAndre was first team all NBA 2 years ago, and he's been top three defensive player of the year, first team all defense, all that stuff. And he was not yet at that level. He was still the guy who wasn't that far coming off a 4 year 42 million dollar deal. Remember, DeAndre got 4 for 42, and JaVale McGee got basically the same deal, like 4 for 40. And the big debate mm-hmm. that day was, all right, which one of these guys would you rather have? Would you rather have DeAndre, or would you rather have JaVale McGee? Because they're both these athletic centers who are nowhere near their peak. Which way are they going to go? And JaVale went in one direction, and DeAndre went in the complete opposite direction. Part of it yeah. is because DeAndre is a guy who doesn't really care that much if he gets 7 shots a game, and he's still going to go all out defensively. But he wasn't always necessarily like that. I think the best thing that Doc Rivers ever did in Los Angeles was turning DeAndre into the player that he is right now. And that last year with Vinny Del Negro, 2012-13, DeAndre was on such a level where he needed to get the ball. We called it cup of coffee plays. I was writing for clipperblog.com at the time. And we used to call it DeAndre's cup of coffee plays, which is the first play of every single game that season. Vinny Del Negro used to give the ball to DeAndre, and he would get a post up. And yeah. it was the first play of every single game. Chris Paul entry pass to DeAndre Jordan, and it would be some ugly post up, and DeAndre would probably miss the shot, but he'd get his shot. And it would keep him a little more engaged on defense, and they would have, you know, yeah. this rim protector, and he wasn't as good defensively then. Of course not. I mean, now he's really damn good defensively, and he wasn't yet. He had all the potential in the world, and he was still super young, and he hadn't reached it yet. And to his credit, he's worked his behind off, and now he's damn good. But that was something that was an extreme example with Vinny Del Negro doing that every game. Yeah. And I don't think that was great coaching, because I think it kind of feeds into that personality trait, which you should try to improve upon, which was obviously possible because Doc was able to do it. But that's kind of an example of it. And nowadays, like, I don't think Steven is that personality. Steven doesn't care.
No.
He does not care. He's like the lowest maintenance NBA player you will ever find, especially because he's definitely got to be of the – If we're ranking in tiers, like diva tiers, like Steven is the lowest tier diva of any player on a $100 million contract in the NBA. Like I feel really confident in that statement. And so Steven is a guy who, like, yeah, if you just keep him engaged with screens, if you keep engaged with screens and you give him 7 or 8 shots, you know, the DeAndre model, where that's what they do. They keep him engaged because everything is run off that pick and roll with DeAndre. and he doesn't get the ball that often, but it keeps him active. And if you do that with Steven, I think you can get the same result. And I'm not even saying DeAndre's obviously not a diva because he doesn't care about not getting the shots. He's obviously the opposite of that. But Steven is just on such a low level of that I imagine that would work quite well.
Yeah, and also, I mean, one other thing that we were discussing in Vegas, now that it comes to my mind, we were discussing the fact that the common sense is that when you do a screen, you're doing something for another guy. I'm not sure I discussed that with you. Probably yes. Instead, I mean, I think that the screen, the first person that actually is helped by the screen, it's you. Because sometimes you do the screen for you, sometimes you do the screen for yourself, but keeping yourself engaged, and you actually get more if you do screen than what you give out. And this is something that also young people struggle to understand. I mean, it's not that the screen setter is doing something for his playmaker, full stop. No, that's not the case. Because doing the screens, especially if you are like not just a center, but if you are like a guard or a forward or even a playmaker, actually opens so many things for yourself. One guy in this draft that did that on a very high level was Derek White, the guy that San Antonio took, and he did some of that in Summer League. And I think that the smart player understand that a screen is not something just for the other guys. It's also for you. And so, I mean, for Steven in particular, I mean, that could be something that allows him to be much more effective than what he was last season.
And you can find, in case you know, people have zoned this part out, you can find Michele and Nicola's work at chartsidesport.com and some other stuff, which I'll tweet out after I tweet out the podcast on Tuesday morning. I'll tweet out some articles with their work in there as well. Something else I want to talk about with you. I know this is like the longest conversation that any podcasters have ever had about screening. Ever, by the way.
I hope it's for the best and not for like.
Who cares, man? It's August. I literally named. I had Andrew on the podcast last Thursday, and I named the podcast so August because all we talked about the whole podcast we just talked about. Hey, you know, there's nothing to talk about.
Yeah, I heard that.
So yeah, this is much more informative podcasting than we've done in recent podcasts. I owe the listeners something decent after that disaster of a Thursday.
Poor Andrew.
So yeah, we'll blame Andrew for it. It was
okay.
It was Andrew's fault. But anyway, speaking of Andrew, who's now like come up like 12 times in this podcast, he tweeted the other day that Russell Westbrook's 3-point numbers compared to James Harden's 3-point numbers the other day, this past season, and Harden was like 34.7% and Russ is 34.3% and Harden's on 9 attempts and Russ is on 7 attempts. And
yeah,
I asked Andrew, is that something that you think is sustainable? Meaning is Russ's 3-point percentage sustainable moving forward? And I was half joking because I was using sustainable as like a code word from this past season. Is Russ's performance sustainable? And no one on Twitter seemed to get it. And then I realized it was a bad joke. But I also was half serious because I do wonder if Russ's 3-point shooting is going to be able to sustain that percentage. You chimed in because this is how Twitter works, and you said that you do, and I was hoping you could expand on that.
Yeah, actually, I was sending out the tweet, and then I basically sent it half written and half not, so it was a two-part tweet, and then I decided just to leave the first part, and so it was something like, he's practicing that a lot, full stop. So it was like, so yes, but I mean, so yes remained in my iPhone. So basically, I think that one thing that Russ will be able to have next season, it's more open shots. And so, like some guy, I apologize, I don't remember the Twitter handle. He posted the splits for tightly guarded trees and open trees. And so, James Harden was 31 and change percent when tightly guarded, and 37 wide open. And Russ was 28.9 tightly guarded and 36.4 wide open. But actually, also last season, the percentage of threes that Russ took was like maybe 50% or even more was open. So this season, he will be able to have many shots that are open, maybe more shots that are open than last season. And so I think that his percentage will be up because he doesn't have to take those heavily contested free. Maybe yes in crunch time, but throughout the game, I think that he will have more space and he doesn't have to take that shots because the offense will work better. He will have more space to do other stuff. And so the threes, the standstill three, when he actually, try to do two or three fakes and then shots, that will be off, almost off his game. And so I think that percentage is actually absolutely sustainable in not quote sustainable, but actually sustainability.
I think that's totally valid. I'm a little more pessimistic than you are.
Why?
Because even those numbers, those splits that you gave out, which is super interesting, you know, 29% on tightly guarded and 36% on more open threes. Those are higher than his career numbers. And maybe he just became a better shooter last year. I mean, it's possible. But if you look at the mid-range numbers were way down last year. He was like 34% mm-hmm. from beyond 16 feet. And if you consider, I'm going to use a keyword right now for Thunder fans this past year, if you consider the three-point line to just be an arbitrary point of the court, and you want to pick another point of the court where you basically consider it's still a jump shot, and you want to say from beyond 16 feet, his shooting numbers from beyond 16 feet, because he shot really terribly from 16 feet to the three-point line, like really terribly, 34% is really bad on mid-range shots. Mm-hmm. And that was the worst part of his season this past year, at least offensively. That was the worst part of his season. Just his mid-range effectiveness was way down. And if you look at his jump shooting numbers from 16 feet out, they're pretty in line with his jump shooting numbers from 16 feet out with the rest of his career. It's just they're kind of in reverse. He was better from three, or at least more efficient from three than he was from mid-range. And normally he's around 30% from three, and he's normally a little bit better from 16 feet out to the three-point line. And I think it's possible that we're going to see those mid-range numbers come up while seeing those three-point numbers go down a little bit more. Maybe he just became a better three-point shooter and mid-range numbers are going to return to his career average of about 38 or 39% or whatever they are. And the three-point is going to stay at 34, 35% range and he's just a better shooter. It's possible. Some guys become better shooters as they get older, but he's not necessarily doing anything differently. At least he says he's not doing anything differently, and I and nobody else has noticed him doing anything else differently. Sometimes these things are super subtle, and Russell is not the type of person who gives away his secrets. So maybe he changed something so subtle that nobody's really noticed it, and he just doesn't want to tell us because he doesn't like, you know, giving away his you know, whatever he's doing and what he's changing and that kind of stuff, which is possible because it was by far the best three-point shooting season of his career. But I think it's also possible that this was kind of fluke is not the right word because it's not a good enough year to be just like, oh, it's not like he shot like 44% and he's going to come back down. But I think it's possible this was just kind of an outlier when you look at his three-point shooting and it's going to end up coming back down. Plus, people talk about, well, with Paul George there, he's going to have better shot opportunities and all that stuff. A lot of these Russell Westbrook shots, and I think the staunchest Russell, I think even Russell Westbrook would agree on this. A lot of difficult Russell Westbrook shots are not created because of the situation. They're created because there's just shots Russell Westbrook wants to take. And those shots, there's a baseline of those shots. Maybe they come down a little bit with Paul George there, but there's a baseline of those shots, which is just going to stay at the same number because Russell likes taking difficult shots and he's going to dribble himself into difficult contested shots early in the shot clock and he's going to take them. And it's just that I don't imagine that going away because that's just part of who he is as a basketball player.
Yeah, I mean, it's totally fair. I mean, I tend to give like meaning when the numbers are so high, like the attempts, not the percentage actually. So he took like a crazy amount of shots, and his percentage was really something different from the other seasons. And one thing that, yes, he takes like bad shots, but the number of threes that were actually bad shots were far less than the good ones. Like, I don't have the numbers in front of me. I was trying to search in them while discussing, but I was ineffective. And so, I mean, I think that there is a trend there in some sense. And I think that all this season was when Russ had to do like first Alpha Dog, then again Sidekick to KD, then again Alpha Dog. He's actually different. So if you see like Russ last season with KD, I mean, it wasn't the same player. Like it was in some sense, the fact that KD was there gave him like let me phrase that correctly. He has like more room to do mistakes. And last year it wasn't the case. Yes, he had to do everything by himself. But in some sense, from the three-point range, he was like very disciplined, like way more disciplined than James Harden, if you think about that. Like James Harden was 50-50 on crazy shots and good shots. And so I kind of trust that those numbers. And I think that one thing that I did, it was looking at past clips of Russell Westbrook, like very old ones, like 2012 and 2013. Man, his shot now is very, very different. Like it's completely different. He was taking like mid-range shots, completely off balance. Right now, he's way more straight with his body. And if you want to like to go back and watch clips, that is something that actually changed through the years. And now I think that his shooting mechanism is so compact that you can expect like the percentage that goes higher instead of going back to normal.
Oh, the lower body, like 5 years ago, was out of control on his pull-ups.
Yes, exactly.
You're right. You are absolutely right. That is something that in the last half decade or so has completely changed, because his legs would be flailing when he'd shoot a pull-up. You know, and he'd take those 15-foot pull-ups. His legs would be all over the place. And whether they be exactly. because he was trying to draw a foul or because he almost looked like, because he moves so fast, he almost looks like, you know, when you see those cartoon characters that start moving their legs really fast and like kicking up dirt and then they start to run?
Yeah, exactly.
He kind of looks like that when he's in those moments. Like he looks like he's running on the air. Or he looks like, yeah, I mean, it's, yes, you're right. I believe you are 100% right on that. His lower body could be more different than what it was early in his career.
Is that something that was a crucial part of his shots? I'm not sure. Did he need time to adjust? Probably. I think that, I mean, this season would be a good test, because he will have, again, many more open shots than last season. And so if that season goes back to normal, then I was completely wrong, because I mean that would mean that this season he will shoot like a lower percentage, far lower percentage than what he shot last year. And so we'll see, but I have a good amount of trust on this.
All right, well, why don't you tell everybody where they can find you. You guys have done work with Gonzaga. You've got other clients, you know, other teams that you work with in Europe, and I know you're hoping to work with some other professional teams as well. You know, obviously we mentioned you've worked with Vantage and some other places, and I'm going to shout out Nicolo as well, because you guys do this together.
Yes.
Anything else you need to plug? Why don't you give out your Twitter handle also?
It's Mikey Berra, pronounced in an English way, Mickey Berra in Italian, so MikeyBerra. And also chart_side for our project. Yeah, I mean, you cover pretty much everything. Like the main cooperation we had these past few years is with Gonzaga, and this will keep going on this season. And something that we did this year was a collaboration with the Ringer. We covered basically the shot chart data for their draft coverage. You can find that at nbadraft.theringer.com. And yeah, we also did something with Draft Express a couple of years ago. But yeah, right now that cooperation will no longer exist because, again, Draft Express went to ESPN. But yeah, I mean, you cover basically everything.
All right. Awesome. And I will be back on Thursday. You can head to iTunes, subscribe to Locked On Thunder there. If you have questions, if you have comments, you can email lockedonthunder@gmail.com. Find me on Twitter at Fred Katz, FredKatz. And like I said, Thunder Road is going to be a little inactive. I mean, if there's news or anything like that, somebody else will take it. If there's major news, then I'll jump out of vacation. But I am away from work, and I'm home in New York right now, and I'm going to be here for until next week. And I'm back to writing on the 14th. So I'm chilling out. I'm going to have some lobster rolls after this. I'm like living a vacation life right now. I'm feeling real good. And then that's all I got. Michele, thanks for coming on, man.
Thank you. Thank you, Fred.
Yeah, I'm glad we finally did this.
Yeah, me too. Hopefully the listener will enjoy that.
Yeah, we're talking about doing this for a little bit, so it's nice we did it. I'll be back on Thursday, another guest, another podcast. Until then, Locked On Thunder is locking up.